Welcome to Regenerative Mindset. In this podcast, we'll explore fresh ideas and inspiring stories from trusted voices who share practical wisdom on bringing positive change to our lives, our society, and our world. I'm your host, Stacey Pollice. As a psychologist, regenerative farmer, and climate activist, I've developed a deep curiosity for thriving ecosystems. Whether it's on my avocado ranch in Southern California or in the ways we engage with each other. Join me as I chat with brilliant guests who challenge our thinking and expand our understanding of how we can live more sustainably, healthfully, and regeneratively, to give back more than we take. Together, we'll see how personal healing can create a ripple effect that reaches our communities and even the earth beneath our feet. So let's get curious together. Today, I am honored to talk with Gwen Lurie. Gwen began her career as a journalist for ABC News, producing the award-winning documentary Voices from the Attic, which tells the harrowing story of her family's years in hiding during the Holocaust. Her background taught her the importance of resilience, compassion, and standing up for what you believe in. And these values have guided her through many careers as a writer, filmmaker, newspaper editor, and philanthropic leader. Gwen uses her considerable gifts as a storyteller and mobilizer to create positive change in politics, publishing, and humanitarianism. Most recently, she's been on a mission with Giving List Women to shift philanthropic giving to women and girls as they provide the strongest lever for positive change in society. In a world where speaking your truth can be daunting, Gwen emphasizes the power of voicing your beliefs with fairness. Today, we'll dive into how deep meaning and strong values have fueled her journey. Listen in and get motivated to engage your truth with integrity. Hello, Gwen. So good to see you here.
Stacey, how are you?
I'm pretty good, I have to say, although my voice is a little foggy today, so you'll have to forgive me on that one.
Well, it's mirroring the weather.
Yeah, that's right. I know you pretty well. We've gotten to know each other over the last few years, and you're one of my nearest and dearest. And how I'd love to begin today is if you would just share with the audience what brought you to this moment. Like, you're doing so many large public important things. You've done so much in your life. Can you just walk us through a bit of your trajectory? Begin wherever you like, and we'll go back to whatever you miss.
Are we starting with this life or past lives?
You know what? I leave that to you, but I like that you asked.
So let me sort of begin by saying that one of my favorite sayings, and I don't know who said it, so I'm going to personally take credit for it, even though it's not mine, is that the most interesting lives make sense in retrospect. So I'm not so sure that my linear journey is going to make all that much sense. I'm from Southern California. I grew up in Los Angeles. I am the daughter of a Holocaust survivor, which I think absolutely informs certain things about me and my choices. I was very involved growing up in all my schools in student government and ran for student body president, I think, of most every school I ever went to, including UCLA as an undergraduate, which some see as more pathological than impressive, but I put it out there. And then I did some graduate work in international affairs and worked for ABC News for a number of years, starting my professional life, and then worked in Hollywood for a few years, and then became a screenwriter for 20 years.
20 years. It's amazing.
You know, and then I ended up running for the school board here in our community and did that for about 8 years and continued to do writing and ended up raising funds to buy our local newspaper. And to, well, it wasn't really just like that, but it wasn't part of my plan. But you know what they say about plans. And so that's sort of my trajectory. But if I had to boil it down, I would say I've always been a storyteller of one sort or another. And that's sort of my MO in communicating.
Well, you know, I've noticed that for you, the personal and the political, or sort of the larger sphere, really don't separate. It seems like in many things that you do, the way you orient, because I experience you as a very family connected, home based person, but yet your reach is so far, and I just keep seeing it getting farther. It kind of reminds me, you know, those forks that have a little extension on them? It's like you keep getting bigger and bigger, and we're going to talk about your latest and greatest, but I want to know, like, is that just how you're wired, or is it part of your personal ethic or belief?
You know, I think that that is a really fair observation. I think that I have always believed, for whatever reason, that we're kind of only limited by the boundaries of our imagination. And I think part of that was probably my mother and father always saying, you could do anything you want. You could do anything you want. And then, of course, I'd always challenge that by saying, well, what if I wanted to be a trash collector? And they'd always say, well, you could do that. I don't think you'd want to do that. But I think they had kind of very lofty expectations and convinced me and my siblings early on that, even though that didn't always turn out to be true, because life has challenges that get thrown our way. So I think, you know, part of it, I think, was a lot of it goes back to the Holocaust piece, Stacey, because I think that in being intimately knowledgeable about my mother's history, because she talked about it a lot, there are many survivors who don't talk about their trauma. And my mom was very vocal about it. And my sister ended up writing a book about it. And I went to Poland and did a film with my family about, you know, our family experience. So I was very acutely aware of it. And I think what I took from that was a sort of sense of irreverence towards authority, because the powers that be in my mother's life really failed. They really let her down, you know. So in the end, I don't attribute power to people in powerful positions, or I don't necessarily respect people because of their job titles. And I think in some ways that's been painful. And in some ways that's really allowed me to be audacious in my, you know, in my plays I've made in life, because my attitude has always been, well, someone gets to do it.
I mean, your resume, I mean, from an early age, it's like, you know, you mentioned a graduate degree, but it was at Oxford, wasn't it? And then your first job seems to have been, you know, ABC News or something. It's like you really have that lofty and audacious imagination. And I love what you just said. It really does answer some curiosity for me, but I love it. And I would say these times really ask for that kind of imagination, and especially in women. And I'm curious to know if you feel that as a woman, a businesswoman, has that shown up for you, the difference between being a woman or a man? Or is it just really not an issue? Like, as a human, you just think beyond some of the barriers.
I don't remember, and I think about this a lot, because Stacey, you and I are both involved with a lot of women who have been involved for a long time and longer than I have in women's issues and in breaking glass ceilings and all of that. And I think that certainly I got to stand on the shoulders of the work that was done by a lot of these women. So I may not have needed sharp elbows the same way that some of our predecessors did. But I don't remember ever feeling shy about competing against boys. And certainly in school, when I ran for office, it was always against boys. You know, I coached T-ball when I was younger, and I coached mostly little boys. But it wasn't until I entered the workplace, like the real workplace in my post-educational life, that I realized that, oh, it is actually different for women. And that manifested in a sexual way, right? It's like, oh, you're a woman when you walk into the room, and it's unclear why people want you in that room. And it can be confusing and disappointing, you know? So certainly the whole hashtag me moment that is more than a moment that we are living through speaks to me loudly, because that certainly informed and impacted a lot of my career.
And so you were exposed to all of that, I'm sure, especially as a beautiful woman and in media, in important rooms that may have been undermining in your own history. I haven't heard you talk about it much, but I'm sure it was present. But I love your audacity. And what I would also want to notice is your trademark sassy wit. Like your humor, I would say, is a, I don't know if I want to say gentle, it's a very fair weapon. And I think it really works. The way you use it really works beautifully. Are you aware?
I do want to go back to one thing you just said. I appreciate the compliment when you use the word beauty, but I do not think that experience is unique to women who look any particular way. I think that, you know, as long as you have breasts, it's going to happen to you. So I, you know, I'm not sure. My wit. Well, look, I think that I was born into a family where sense of humor was a big part of our interaction. I married someone who is a comedy writer and, you know, very funny. And, you know, we raised two kids who are funny. So, you know, I'm always having to keep up with the funny people. But I think that one of the casualties, hopefully temporary, of this moment is sense of humor. And I think that sense of humor can be a very disarming thing. And it also allows us to laugh at the elephant in the room. You know, it allows us to laugh at the very human things about all of us that are funny because we all recognize it. You know, we all recognize it as our imperfections, if there's such a thing. And it also just makes life more fun. I think that we have become so serious and we take ourselves so seriously that we stop even recognizing our own human frailties and flaws and what connects us as human. So anyway, I also think it impacts the creative journeys of everyone, not just artists, but people in everyday life. And so I value that. And that's what I value about you, Stacey. I mean, we laugh a lot. And that is, you know, I don't think that undercuts the level of our conversations or of our connection. I think it actually improves upon it.
And I would say that's beautifully put. Play is something that I believe nature sort of set us up for. So we come from the factory, all of us, learning through play. So that's a really important piece for me as well. Keeping the sense of play, and what you're alluding to, it sounds like, is as the grease for the wheel of creativity. If we're playing, more is possible, because as I've learned in my research, fear makes you stupid. And so I think we find ourselves a little constricted. We have a lot of reasons to have some fear, but I think it's important to have the discipline almost of play. And I feel like you have cultivated it and you practice it. And I find it in your work with the Montecito Journal. You're very serious. You're very hard-hitting at times, very direct. But you keep a really irreverent sense of play in that as well, in that medium, which I appreciate.
Thank you. And I'm not saying this falsely with any sort of false modesty. I don't know that I know another way of doing it. It is how I kind of meet the moments in my life. I think there's so much pain in this world and profundity and heaviness and suffering that it is what gives me perspective, and I hope gives other people perspective. You know, the other piece of it is that I really think I'm sort of bringing this other idea into it, which is different than sense of humor. You sort of said the fork that keeps getting longer, you know, that allows me to keep kind of growing as a human being and in my work. And this goes back to the irreverence piece. And you've heard me say this, I know. I do not think leadership is a fancy title. I don't think leadership is a big bank account. I think leadership is something that we all choose to show up with or not. And so I think that people all every day have a chance to lead if they take that chance. So maybe I've taken that chance more than some people have, but I think that's more because my mother and father always told me I could, you know, that somehow I grew up feeling like I was worth being listened to. And so I believed it. And I think, you know, some people don't have that inherent belief, which is not to say the listening isn't important, because that's a key piece of leadership too.
Absolutely, which you have to do in your job. Well, that's so encouraging too, because the idea of intergenerational trauma through a Holocaust survivor, I mean, I've known other people and talked to other people, and I know intergenerational trauma is so real. And it feels like through your mother's willingness or desire to actually talk about it, maybe somehow was healing and has allowed for something greater to come through without it feeling compensatory, is what my sense is. So it's just more like possibility was expanded. It's like we've seen the worst. Now anything's possible. Ooh, that just gave me a chill.
I like that. I think that's a really interesting way of putting it. I mean, we all know this. There are many forms of trauma, and Holocaust survivors are not the only survivors of trauma. We're surrounded. We live in a trauma-informed world more and more. And I think that what it gave me was, yes, a sense of possibility that one could rise from the ashes, that there's that phoenix-like possibility for human beings if they choose that. But it also gave me, I think, empathy. You know, that like I see trauma and I see pain, and I have a lot of respect for that journey and sadness for that journey. But I do think that hope is such an important thing. That's why I love the idea of having survivors of one trauma speak to and come together to meet other trauma survivors, because I think we all need that example in our lives that someone else did it, you know, that I'm not alone. So yes, I think for us, for my family, it was the Holocaust. And certainly this moment has triggered a lot of feelings about that. But I think there are so many other trauma survivors around us that have to have their journey honored, and that they too need examples of people who have survived that so that they can learn from it and not be resigned to reliving it.
Well, this makes me think about your role with the Montecito Journal. I mean, the community of Montecito and Greater Santa Barbara is very particular. It's a very influential, often elite, very educated group who tend to come here to really unwind and relax. So it's a unique community. And here you are editing a paper that really tries to communicate the community back to itself and a little bit of the world, but very much about the community. And I want to hear a little about what that's like being that voice or the editor of that voice in such a community. What are the blessings? What are the challenges? What are some of the snares that are inherent in your job?
Well, I think being the complaint department for any community has its challenges. I have a lot of respect for the people in this community. I think not just Montecito, but Santa Barbara in general. I mean, I think it is filled with some of the most interesting people I've ever met. And I think that one of the challenges of taking over this paper was meeting that level of not expectation, but what I thought this community deserved, which was real conversation about real things and about how what's going on in the world sort of reflects itself and shows itself here in our local community. And I think there's almost never a way not to tie something bigger back to here, which we always try to do. I have had people, you know, say to me, God, you wrote that piece on X and it was so brave. Like, I was so courageous or so brave. And I don't think of it that way. I don't go, wow, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to be brave. I sort of just say what I think is the truth. And I don't worry about who it's going to upset, except that I'm sensitive to my own biases. And I try to acknowledge those biases. And I try to say something that is constructive. Anyone can sit on the sidelines and say what's wrong. So I try to bring some hope or some perspective that maybe people didn't have before they read something I wrote. But I also am very helped by, I have to give a plug to my partner, Tim Buckley, because we really come to life with a very different perspective politically. And that's a rare thing to have two people in this context work together. And Tim reads everything I write, and he will often say, if you take out this one line, people may not agree with you, but they'll at least be able to hear what you have to say. You know, this one trigger line or this one, because mm-hmm. we all say things that are going to piss people off. And sometimes that's what you're trying to do. But sometimes you're really trying to get people to listen. I'm not always trying to provoke.
But, I mean, you have been honored by Democratic Women of Santa Barbara as Women of the Year. So where you stand politically and ideologically, humanitarian issues is very clear. And so I love the honesty because I can trust your voice if you tell me where you stand and you're not just trying to weave between and just, you know, please all people. That doesn't really work, but it's risky. And it makes me wonder, I mean, have you ever gotten any hate mail or is it hard? I feel like journalism is risky and even more so today. Maybe it always is, but it feels more so today.
It's risky. Anytime you put yourself out there, it's risky. I'm sure if you haven't already, you're going to get comments on your podcast. Of course I get hate mail. There are people out there with a lot of hate. And anytime you put yourself out there in any meaningful way, I think people are going to have opinions about it. And by the way, I am not pretending to have super thick skin. I do not. It gets to me sometimes, you know, for sure. And I remember my husband saying to me very early on, he said, just remember that at the height of his popularity, Barack Obama had 50% of the country that wanted him gone. That hated his guts. And I think that that's important to remember, that people have strong opinions about things, including people we think of as great artists. You know, some people hate them. So it's not easy to hear. And I do often see the one hand not clapping, for sure. But I decided a long time ago that the thing that makes me the saddest, the thing that fills me the most with regret is not having tried, not having done the thing. I very rarely regret doing the thing, unless I was coming from not an authentic place, in which case then you got to rethink what your motivation was. But if you're doing something from an authentic place, I think I can live with that.
To me, that sounds courageous. I know you don't identify, but I hear that as courage, and I think it's a great example to the rest of us. I'd like to touch in again on the periodicals. So you work with your husband less. Number one, what's it like working with your husband? And number two, I'd love to hear more about, like, what are all of the periodicals? I want to make sure that we capture what they all are because you do many things.
Well, the what's it like to work with my husband piece, Stacey, I feel like I should be laying down on the couch for that part. Whenever Les and I work together, we always joke that all roads lead to no intimacy. Let me start by saying that. So I am very lucky to be married to a multi-talented person who is one of the best writers I know. And back in the day was the editor of National Lampoon. He was the head writer on a show called In Living Color, like for years, and other comedy shows. And so he's funny. He's very funny. And that can be annoying sometimes. But he's a great editor, is what he is. He's a great editor. And we do very different things. So we don't write together, but he will always read what I write and gives me amazing feedback. And I try to do the same for him. So, you know, he launched the Riv magazine through the Montecito Journal Media Group, which is design and architecture in the American Riviera. He is a design builder, has been since he was 20. In addition to his writing, he's always loved architecture. My house is overrun with architecture and design books. You know, he's very talented and he sees things that other people don't see. And that's true in design and that's true in just people's lives and ideas. He's a great storyteller. And I think his concept was he wanted to bring back content to magazines. He wanted for people to be able to deliver on the visual porn, on the design porn, but also who are the people who are doing these things and what is their journey and why is this interesting? And I think most magazines these days, you can finish before getting to the checkout stand. But you remember the days you used to be so excited to get a magazine and you would read it. And he really, you know, endeavors to bring that back. And I think he's done a great job. And the magazine's been very successful. And he also took over the Montecito Journal Glossy magazine. So he edits those. And again, he brings a level of expectation to the work, which is hard to meet because you're not getting rich off of this necessarily. So the magazines are great. The newspaper is really fun. And we have a managing editor, Zach Rosen, who sort of does the day-to-day of the newspaper. And Tim Buckley also always has his eye on that. And I get involved in kind of the big picture and also in writing my pieces. But that day-to-day is great. And again, we try to give members of the community an opportunity to have a voice, even if they disagree with something I wrote or something someone else wrote. And we really allow for that so that people feel like it's not just my opinion or our opinion. So that's really important to me. I mean, one of the reasons that it was interesting to try to take on the local newspaper was that I think that this community, probably every community, is filled with people that have stories worth telling. And, you know, I think there are no boring stories. There are only boring reporters, someone once said to me. And I think that's true because if you read the most interesting memoirs, they're not necessarily on paper the most interesting lives. But a great story is a great story if it's told well. So I do think that that is what we try to do. And then, of course, there's the philanthropy piece.
I just want to say the depth of the work that is done in these magazines that you two produce and even the newspaper. I'm a huge fan of magazines, and it's a telltale when I keep them way beyond their expiration date. That tells you something, and your magazines and papers are worth keeping for a long time. So, yeah, that's my sign. But yes, indeed, I really would love if you would walk us through your process with the Giving List and then the Giving List Women, which has blown my mind and opened up so much in my own understanding of what this moment requires of us as women and as citizens. So could you talk to us a little bit about that process and what led you to it?
So the process began really with conversations I had with Tim Buckley when we started, sort of thinking about how we can make our newspaper and adjacent publications more relevant and meaningful to this community. And the one thing that you can't not know from being here is that philanthropy is a huge piece of life in Montecito and in Santa Barbara. And it is really how people get together socially. It's how people identify each other by the causes they care about much more than the work, you know, their professional track. And Santa Barbara has more nonprofits per capita than any county in the country.
That's a staggering statistic, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, but not really so surprising when you add the per capita. And some people think there are too many. But we sort of, you know, thought, and from my own experience having served on nonprofit boards, you know, I know that most or many nonprofits struggle to tell their own story in a powerful way. And yet we know that it is a really important way to raise money and raise awareness is to pull on people's heartstrings and to pull them in from, you know, a storytelling perspective. So we decided, what if we published a book in Santa Barbara that, you know, told the story of 50 or 75 nonprofits, and you choose different ones every year in part, and you tell their story in a powerful way, you put it in a book that people don't want to throw away, you know, that's nice enough that people will keep on their table for the year, and they'll use it and they'll dog ear it and they'll flip through it when it comes to their giving, and they will be exposed to nonprofits they didn't know exist. Because the other piece of it is that donors, philanthropists at every level, the most well-meaning ones I know, it is often very low-hanging fruit. There is often not that much due diligence that goes into really truly understanding what your options for giving are. So a lot of it is, who are your friends? What dinner or what gala were you invited to? So we really wanted people to understand the gamut of their choices. So we did that, and many organizations raised a lot of money, in some cases, six figures, from sending this book out to the biggest donors, tens of thousands of donors in the community. So we ended up expanding to Los Angeles and the Bay Area, and doing a Giving List Bay Area, Giving List Los Angeles, and a Giving List Santa Barbara. So we have three publications, and, you know, we're going on year four. And, you know, a lot of millions of dollars have been raised with the help of these publications, because they're a tool as much as a fun book to read. So that's been great. And then a few years ago, I got a call. I think you know this, but I got a call from my friend Stacy Keir, who was not my friend before. I didn't know her, but she's in the Bay Area. She has a family foundation, focuses a lot on women and girls in her work. And she just blind called us and said, I love the Giving List Bay Area book. My family uses it for our philanthropy. Would you ever consider doing a Giving List Women? And it was just one of those aha moments for me. I went, oh, that just makes so much sense. And I really spent the next 6 months or so just talking to everyone I could reach who was really deeply invested in that world. And so I kind of just Tarzaned my way from person to person. And I just came to understand very quickly some of those shocking statistics that we talk about, right? Which is what a small percentage of philanthropy currently goes to organizations that focus on women and girls, which is less than 2%, and much less so for women and girls of color. And so when you couple that with this other piece, which is that there is so much evidence that the strongest lever for change in almost every category of philanthropy is lifting up women and girls. And for change for all of us, for boys, for men, for women, for girls, for GDPs of countries, for
the environment.
100%. So most people would say, oh, well, girls and women are great, but that's not really my lane. And so what we've endeavored to do is to create a shift in thinking so that donors understand that women and girls must be a lens, not a lane of philanthropy, whether you care about the environment or social justice or culture, or whatever it is that motivates you? Because the one thing we know about, and you know this, Stacey, because you and your family certainly do your share in supporting important organizations, is that it is impact that you're looking for. People want to have impact, whether you're putting in $50 or $50 million. You want to know that money means something, that it's not just being washed away. That's been a really interesting process. So we have created the Giving Less Women book that just went out. We have 100,000 copies out. We're going out with 50 more thousand copies around the world to giving circles all over the country. And we are telling the story of 50 organizations around the world that focus on women and girls in every area of work, and telling their stories in the context of the pervasiveness of the importance of lifting up women and girls in every area of philanthropy. And we curated the book the first year with the help of all of our partner organizations. We're really creating a network of networks. We're not reinventing the wheel on this work. There are so many amazing organizations out there doing incredible work. So, you know, we're working with the Gates Foundation. We're working with Global Fund for Women and Philanthropy Together and Annie Casey Foundation and Grantmakers for Girls of Color and Curved Foundation and Linked Foundation and Annenberg Foundation and California Community Foundation. And we have about 20 partner organizations this year, and that's growing. And they helped us choose the organizations, curate the book. And then this next year, it'll be an application process. So organizations are now applying to be in the 2025 book.
Well, that's a question I was going to ask you is, number one is, how does one get in the book? And number two is, how does one get a copy of the book? Like, if a listener was really like, wow, I mean, it's on my reading table and I do sit down and read it. It's well written and it's in categories and deeper descriptions. So you really get to know these philanthropies and the whys of them. But I'm curious to know how people could get a hold of this, because it's so powerful what you're doing.
Yeah, it is thegivinglesswomen.com. And you can go there, and the book is online, but you can also order a copy of the book and we'll get sent to you. And you can also sign up the application to apply for an organization to be in the next Giving List Women book is there and can be easily downloaded. And we've tried to create a relatively simple process for application. We know that the time and resources that go into grant applications, we're not trying to make extra work. We really want to help these organizations. Tell us your story. Tell us why you should be in this book. And then we have some criteria that they have to meet, but it's all, I think, very reasonable.
Well, I have to back up and say that less than 2%, you know, 2% being on a good day of all philanthropy going to women and girls, is just shocking in itself. And when I've repeated that, and I repeat it often, because this whole project has really blown my socks off. So, and it's motivating, but it's hard to imagine that it's actually true. But when I've spoken to friends, let's say, that are deeply involved in philanthropy, when I've said that statistic, they go back to look and say, well, where are our grants going? Where is our philanthropy going? They found a majority to boys and men, interestingly. And the answer for why is, well, the girls are better at applying for other scholarships. Yeah, but, you know, the thing is, the boys seem to be somehow being highlighted more. I don't know how that is. But just having it be data-driven the way you are doing it, and in partnership with some of these great organizations like Gates, who is actually doing the data and all the research, really helps.
And Lilly Family School of Philanthropy at University of Indiana has been another partner, and they've been very helpful in terms of providing data. And they also work with Gates. So a lot of these silos do communicate with each other and support each other. It's shocking. I mean, look, statistics are complicated and you could break them down different ways. You know that as an academic. And it's tricky, right? It's less than 2% of all philanthropic dollars go to organizations that primarily focus on women and girls, which means that 80% or more of their resources go towards women and girls. The fact of the matter is, if you read, there was a really good piece in The Guardian several months back that really talked about how there's not gender equality in a single country on earth. And the fact that we are so excited, some of us, about the prospect of having a woman president in this country, that with all of the amazing American women, we've not had a woman leader in this country. I mean, many countries have, including countries that we don't think of as progressive as we think of our own. And yet we've never had a woman leader. And I am just such a strong believer that people need to be at the table representing their different needs, their different values, their different points of view. And it can't just be set dressing. And I mean that in terms of DEI. I mean that in terms of getting women at the table. It's like we all need to come to understand the value that is derived for all of us when we have a diversity of perspectives. Because in the end, most of us don't want to live under the rules of either extreme, right? I mean, extremes are fine in shaping a conversation. But at the end of the day, in my opinion, what is the most productive and healthy is to have compromises in which we all can see pieces of ourselves, that everyone sees their own needs reflected in those compromises. Maybe not 100%. Right? Because it's like, you know, just from being in a family, if one person always gets their way, you have all the other people are unhappy, right? So it's like, we have to, you know, sometimes you win a little more than I do, sometimes I win a little, but it's that process of talking things through and understanding why something is so meaningful to you and why something is so meaningful to me that really gets us to a better place. I think that's why some people say, like people who are married or in long-term relationships end up evolving more as humans, because you have to listen to something other than yourself, right? You have to break out of that algorithm that we all now in a bigger way find ourselves in online, which is just infinite mirrors of ourselves. And that is not, in the end, it's not interesting. And it's also not helpful. And it just allows us to entrench further and further in believing that we're right. And I think being right is overrated. You could be dead right.
It's a sugar buzz is what it is, I think. That's how I see it.
And I had a friend whose mother used to say, just because you're the loudest doesn't mean you're right.
Oh, yeah. Although I am pretty loud and I am pretty right, I think. So the book is the major piece of Givingless Women, but you also hosted an incredible summit in April. And I want to talk about that. But what I want to say is that what I experienced was not only an incredibly high level of attendance in terms of who was there, the people that are making huge differences globally doing it was really impressive, but also, and very importantly, was the diversity of the crowd. And I mean, it wasn't window dressing. And I shared with you that when I experienced the literal, actual diversity there, I mean, it was primarily women, but there were men there and there were transgender people there. And there were women of color and men of color. What I noticed for myself was I had an experience that when I see the multiplicity represented, the message it gives me is that my inner multiplicity, my parts, I am a psychologist, remember, all of me gets to show up so I can relax and actually bring more. And again, it's that fear makes you stupid. I don't have to narrow myself or my message or my connection. So I connected deeply with many people at this event, and it has really changed my life. So could you talk a bit about what the summit is and will be?
The summit was, in year one, was really a way of bringing the book to life and to creating an opportunity for relationship building among the members of this network of networks. So to bring together nonprofit leaders, philanthropic leaders, philanthropists, some policy people, to really talk about what is this moment that we're in? And what does it demand of us? So there were two objectives. One was to really provide both foundation leaders and philanthropists with a fact-based justification to apply the lens of women and girls to their giving. So that's just part of the goal of wanting to push, in the end, billions of dollars towards this work, which it is worthy of. And I believe we would all benefit from the fruits of that. So that's number one. Number two, it was exploring bringing together all of these really interesting people. And again, we did not chase celebrity, Stacey, you know that. Like no, we made a decision very early on that the celebrities are the people who are doing this work. So were there some famous people there? A few, yes, but only the people who really got the value of being there. Like the people who said, how much are you going to pay me? And can I be the keynote? It was like, yeah, this probably isn't for you this year. Like, and in the end, we kind of created a no keynote zone, as you know. It was conversations between really interesting people and the community. And I think everyone felt like that stood out as different. Everyone felt seen and acknowledged, and it came with something to teach and something to learn. And I think that was probably, at least in part, why it felt like a meaningful experience to you and to me. So the other piece of it is, once you're building this network of networks and expanding the tent of people who belong and join the group under that tent, we want to have conversations about leadership and what does it look like, not just when women lead, but when people lead differently. What do women bring to that occasion? Because we all know that women are just as capable of tribalism and poor leadership, right? We're not born knowing how to lead. So, and we have been leading under the banner of patriarchy for so long. So patriarchy is not just about men at this point. It's about a system that we've all sort of accepted as brutal and a given. And I don't accept it as either. And, you know, I think that it is refreshing to sort of say, God, what if we just did this differently? Like, I think we all look around the world and think if there were more women leaders, there would probably be less war. What is it about what we bring to the table that is valuable and meaningful? And how can we bring men into that conversation and help the world evolve in that direction? And then the other piece of it, just throwing one other piece, is really looking at, you know, we've all sort of said this to each other, like, whoever said we all have to agree on everything to work together? Like, that seems to be this weird thing that has happened over the years with like feminism or civil rights or DEI or in Jewish groups or in any, it's like, we're not women's groups of any kind. It's like, we're not monolithic. There's not one feminist perspective. If there's a feminist perspective, it's that we believe in equity and equality and in the value of that. And we hopefully can believe in the value of hearing different perspectives and having respect for each other's journeys. And maybe even eventually we can come to agree upon the futility of canceling everyone who doesn't see the world the way we do. Because in the end, I think a lot of us think that is not healthy and that is not getting us where we want to go.
I agree with you 100%. And I would say, with nature as my guide through both the Taoism philosophy I study, but also as a farmer, and also what I've found in my own research, that's not how nature does it. Like, a truly life-promoting system usually is diverse, usually is complex, usually has a great deal of connection, communication, and what I would say is care. I mean, as we find the mother tree in a forest of any kind, they share their resources with others. And that was an experience I would say I got almost by the multiplicity of being at this full day event was by witnessing the many different ways women do things when they have the power, the money, the voice, the organization. When I experienced it as a whole and then digested it, because it was a lot, it was that drinking from a fire hose experience. But it was a teaching, because as a woman in the world, I don't have a lot of examples of how do I do this? How would we imagine it? Having the imagination of what would a more balanced world look like? I'm learning regenerative farming practices, learning about how soil that's highly functional has all these qualities that, guess what? When a society is highly functional, has those same qualities.
So what are those qualities?
Well, again, that the more diversity, the better. Like, nature doesn't love a monocrop. So that increases resilience. High levels of communication is essential. And we're finding the mycorrhizal or fungus really plays that part to a large extent. I think that having those positive inputs and really not introducing deterrence. So I'm trying to come up with how I would word that. So herbicide, pesticide, fungicide, all the sides. And what are those in our society? How do we introduce things that might minimize or try to kill off or separate out parts of our society that aren't convenient? You know, Van Jones talks about what it costs to help educate a young man in a gang versus what it costs to imprison such a person. It's like, you know, that doesn't make any sense. So by separating, isolating, thinking that we can do that, you know, Descartes did his thing. Now, could you please, you know, leave the room, Descartes? This idea of separating mind, body, spirit, and we've done it to a real extent. I think it's a necessary part of our culture, but I think we're at the part now where we have to imagine unification. And so what you spoke to about holding complexity and finding, I'm toying with this notion of compromise versus consensus, whereas compromise, I have to give up, where consensus, we just have to stay with it a little bit longer until we can all agree on something. And I'm curious, that leads me to this idea of what do you imagine for Giving List Women going forward, both in terms of project, but also in terms of summit? And what are we looking towards with Giving List? Because I'm excited.
Right. I just looked up compromise. An agreement or a settlement of a dispute that is reached by each side making concessions, an ability to listen to two sides in a dispute and devise a compromise acceptable to both. So really, in its definition, we're probably talking about the same thing. I love that you are a regenerative farmer and you're doing this podcast that is so much broader than that, because the metaphors are so palpable, right? It's like diversity is critical to nature thriving, that nature doesn't love a monocrop, right? High levels of communication are necessary in order to have a successful crop, that toxins destroy a crop. And I think that what we're experiencing now in our world are so many sides. So I want to say S and C, right? And we all know what it's like. We've all had jobs where there's someone who's toxic. Like, we talk about a toxic personality, you know, it's like the one bad apple, you know, we have all these expressions for it. And there are so many bad apples right now. And I don't just mean that in terms of players, but in terms of ideas and approaches to communication, values.
So do we value connection and each other and humanity? I want to introduce one more in farming, and you tell me if you find it. Speed. I feel like time scarcity, a desire to do faster, more, quicker. I find that in nature, that's a real issue. And I wonder if we find that, like, if we could develop nature's pace, could it make a difference taking the time to actually be with each other, which I think is what I'm hearing when you decided to do a summit. Like, oh my God, was that an endeavor? And it took a lot of time, and actually spending time together in real life. All my plants, my ecosystem has been watered for months and will be for years. I'll tell you that much right now.
Well, I think that's so interesting. We have to have a much longer conversation about all of the metaphors in your work, because I think that is really, really helpful as a frame. Absolutely. I mean, we live in a world where the attention span is not just of our children, but, you know, we all spend so much time on the phone. We Google things quickly. We have opinions so quickly. People don't work in jobs for a long time anymore and kind of work their way up. So by the time they're atop, they really understand every level of a business. It's like everything just happens fast. Have you ever cooked a piece of meat or fish in a microwave and said, yum, that's delicious?
Right. It's a convenience. Gets the job done quick.
It's a convenience and there's a price. So to answer your question, you know that the summit started with an evening of small dinners around Santa Barbara. And you hosted one of the dinners. And so 12 residents in Santa Barbara hosted dinners for 12 to 15 guests. We tried to kind of divide people up in terms of like areas of interest and whatnot. And really the idea was no side conversations. Everyone gets a chance to share why they're there, what they're hoping to get out of this experience. And it turned out to be, in some ways, at least the feedback I've gotten and how I felt about our dinner, just the best part of the event, because everyone showed up at the event already having kind of a community of people they felt connected to. And it really expedited the process of relationship building. And, you know, any of us who have social anxiety or whatever to show up at a summit where you don't know a lot of people, like that was kind of a race because everyone came with friends. So that was great. And we are creating the Giving List Women in a Box. And we are going to be pushing these dinners out around the country because the idea is to grow the tent of people who can finally feel good about being part of something that isn't demanding of them that they think exactly like everyone else does, that it's coming together based on norms and values of existing in the world together and understanding the value that will come of lifting up our daughters and our mothers and our sisters and bringing men into that process too, because it isn't at the expense of men. You know, women need men, men need women. We're all, you know, together better. So this is not intended to say, look, you know, drop your sperm at the door. We don't need you. But that is not the ethos of this. And I was, you know, very thrilled to have the men there who were there. And hopefully there will be even more next time. Your husband was one of them. My husband was one of them. But I think the men who were there really were changed by this. I think they kind of had their own aha moments where they didn't walk away feeling threatened. They walked away feeling part of something that is important for all of us. And I think that's really the hope. So we're going to push out the dinners. We're going to continue to have the summit. We're going to continue to have the book. We are building something else that I'm not prepared to talk about yet that will hopefully throw off a lot of revenue to women around the world and nonprofits around the world and boost what I think is one of the most important things, which is financial independence or security for women. Because when you know that you can support yourself, you have many more choices. And we all know that. You know, you have the choices to leave a bad situation. You have the choices to pursue an interesting business idea. So that's a really big piece. And, you know, Sherry Blair Foundation, all these, you know, Weave in Santa Barbara, which is one of the organizations in our book, and they took place, you know, Women's Environmental Ventures. I'm sorry, Economic Ventures, which, you know, it's people understand this. And so the other thing we're building will really help you know, undergird that effort. So yeah, it's big. And by the way, there are things that will come out of this that I have no idea that our partners will start. And we're really here to also lift up all the work that's being done that is not coming out of our office. You know, we want to support everyone who's kind of trying to row in the same direction, which is to a better place.
Well, for me, this epitomizes a regenerative mindset. And believe it or not, the humanitarian, environmental, economic, all of it actually joins in creating a more positive, thriving future on all levels. I mean, I have a particular interest in climate and the environment, but I mean, everything is related. And I think that's what this organization, what this group you've created is doing. So thank you so much. And I could go on and on, but we will. So could you just let us know, like, do you have a couple of key thoughts or takeaways that you would love to send listeners with today?
I mean, I just go back to a couple of things we've talked about and put a fine point on it, which is that as easy as it is to exist in this world and feel powerless to change, because I know many people feel like, what is one vote? What is one vote in California where you have a feeling it's going to go a certain direction anyway, or in, you know? And I really do think that we are all leaders. And if you have an idea, ideas are easy, but it's investing in that and really seeing it through. And if you're willing to fail, you could really win. And I think that it's very hard to win if you're not willing to fail. So that's one thing. And someone actually said to me the other day, actually it was Hannah Beth Jackson, our former state senator, who said to me, failure is not trying. And I thought that was a very kind of interesting way of saying it. The other piece of it is just that lift up women and girls. If you care about the environment, lift up women and girls. If you care about education, lift up women and girls. Whatever it is, there is an argument to be made for that being the strongest way to move the lever on what you're thinking about. That's not at the exclusion of boys. And by the way, I want to say that one of the chapters in our book is our solidarity with men and boys and supporting organizations that really help boys to learn how to work with girls, how to respect girls, how to value the partnership of girls and women. And so I think that that's a really important piece of this too. And, you know, finally, if you have something that you believe, say it and don't worry about being canceled. Because at the end of the day, if you're thoughtful, if you explain why you feel a certain way, I find that most people are willing to listen. It's with the strong opinions where there's no roadmap to why. You know, why do you feel this way? Who are you that you come to feel this way? And I think that there's a context for all of our opinions and all of our thoughts. And I think when you share that context, it helps people to understand and be more patient with points of view that don't necessarily jibe with their own. So those are my little wishes for all of us. And yeah, but I really appreciate all that you're doing too, Stacey. I think you're doing an amazing job and so honored that you wanted to talk to me on your show.
Please come again, because you have inspired so much for me and I hear so much wisdom mixed with so much play, which is just the secret sauce, in my opinion. So thank you so much for all the work you're doing and for being here today.
Thank you for being a part of it.
Yeah, take care. Thank you for tuning in. If today's conversation inspired you, you can help us reach more people by sharing this episode with friends or leave a review. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. For additional resources, you can visit my website and stay connected with me on social media. A big thanks to the amazing team that makes this podcast possible, including Phil Svitek, Brianna Phipps, Leah Pellegrini, Melissa Walbridge, and Courtney Hamilton. When we all work together, we can create a world where positive change is not just possible, but inevitable.